I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Simon, thanks so much
for
joining us.
Is that right?
That's great.
Is
yeah,
it
you
the
don't...
best Curzon podcast you've ever been involved in?
Absolutely, yes.
Better than Isabel Huppert?
Yeah, I mean, who cares about Isabel Huppert when you've got Simon Amstel, you know?
Hello and welcome to another Curzon Film Podcast. In this episode, Lucas Daunt's ballet school set Girl keeps us on our toes, and Simon Amstel channels Ice Cube to tell us all about the Benjamin. I'm Jake Cunningham, and to help get to the point of these two pieces about performance are the pals de deux, Ella Kemp and Caitlin Quinlan.
Hello.
Hello.
And holding up the bar, Sam Howlett's here too.
Hi.
And before we get to Simon Amstel and that chat about Benjamin, let us start with Girl. Based on a real-life story, Girl follows determined 15-year-old Lara, played by Victor Polster, who is committed to becoming a professional ballerina after starting at a new Belgian ballet school. Though supported by her father, Lara's adolescent frustrations and impatience are heightened as she prepares for gender reassignment surgery. Having been born a boy, she faces a world that questions her gender and selfhood while also taking on the intense physical demands of a dancer's life. This is the debut film from Belgian director Lucas Daunt. And central to this film is, of course, Victor Polster, who has to carry the weight of it all on his shoulders. Caitlin, what do you make of this performance?
Yeah, so Victor Polster has obviously been cast. He's a male ballet dancer cast in this transgender role. So Lucas Daunt actually called for blind casting. That's part of the reason why Polster was cast. Anyone of any gender could audition. And it's been said that Nora Montsecour, who the film is based on, the dancer the film's based on, approved the casting of Polster. So there's some interesting debates to be had around that. But I think he gives a wonderful performance. I think it's quite sort of delicate and very moving at times, actually, I found. But yeah, there's some issues over that that people have raised. But for the film, yeah, I think he gives a wonderful performance.
Yeah, and it must be said, this film is a representation of the trans experience, and it's been lauded and criticised in near equal measure, really. It's got a lot of awards, but then to counteract that, I mean, there's certainly been criticism of it as well, and it's important to acknowledge that this has become a controversial film. And before we delve further into it, it's definitely worth saying that nobody speaking here identifies as a member of the trans community, and so our responses are those as observers, and there are certainly complexities here that we couldn't come close to understanding, really. And I would urge listeners to seek out criticism on the film from trans critics as well. Ella, you saw this film quite a while back now, and the opinion on it has transformed. I'm curious how you first reacted to it.
Yeah, so when I first saw this film, it wasn't really on my radar, and there are a lot of people individually who recommended it, and you know, they described it as this really delicate hidden gem about this incredible story, and I was very moved by it when I first saw it. But it is really interesting and kind of vital to see the amount of time that's passed and the gap when, you know, it goes around festivals and anywhere else. And then when the criticism started coming out, it was months after I'd first seen it. And all the criticism that I read is completely valid. And I just found it so, so important to have that perspective that was completely different to my own, but also to the other people who had seen the film at the same time as me. So yeah, it's really quite important to see how that's evolved, I think.
Mm. And so along with Victor Polster's central performance, there's a key supporting role. Aria Rortwalter as Matthias, who plays Lara's dad. And it's an opportunity that I want to talk about that in modern coming-of-age films like this, more teen stories, we're seeing more nice dads, nice parents. Mm-hmm. And although that seems like kind of a throwaway thing, I actually think that's a really important thing. And that if I was... like 10, 15 years younger, these are the dads that I wish I was seeing.
Absolutely. And there's been so many just in the past like 2 years or something. So, and these dads are always dealing with kind of difficult and different situations. Like their teenage children, both sons and daughters, are going through so many different things, like with their identity and sexuality and confidence and all of it. So, you know, you've got the dad in Call Me By Your Name, played by Michael Stuhlbarg, who's dealing with Elio's sexuality and, you know, his first big romance. Then you've got the dad in Eighth Grade, finally coming out in the UK soon, and he's dealing with his daughter's crippling anxiety in middle school. And then I think also it's interesting you had Love, Simon last year, where you've got this dad who also has to deal through his son going through a whole thing that he doesn't even know about. And it's really interesting to see how these dads have, well, are allies and have to just adapt to these situations and do it in such an interesting and new way each time. And the dad and girl also does this. I think he's a really terrific character.
Stanley Tucci in Easy A as well.
Absolutely.
It's a bit old now, but he's, yeah, and there's a kind of two crass categories for this. They're either kind of all-knowing and they're like, don't worry, I know you'll get through this. I'll kind of let you work it out on your own. Or they're learning along with their child. And in Girl, Matthias is very much, he doesn't have all the answers. He doesn't know what she's going through, but he's very much like, I'm here for you, even though I don't know what you're going through. And there's that scene in the kitchen where he's, you know, don't tell me you're fine, tell me actually how you're feeling. Mm. So he's learning as along with Lara.
Yeah. Yeah, I think but both of these films that we're talking about today are very much about people, or very much have elements of them that are about people being allowed to speak and having someone to speak to when they feel like maybe they don't.
Mm.
And yeah, I think Easy A is a great shout. And I, if there are young people watching stories that show these kind of parental yeah. relationships, I'm glad they're out there.
Mm-hmm.
Let's delve into ballet for a little bit. We've seen ballet recently in Suspiria.
Yeah.
I mean, the big film from like 10 years ago would have been Black Swan. And ballet is a great way of kind of delving into a psyche. It's giving a kind of physical manifestations to the frustrations and pain that someone might be feeling.
Yeah, well, ballet in film recently is not just a dance anymore. It's like it's a lifestyle. It's a full-on something you have to devote your whole body and mind to. And back in Black Swan, that film's a full-on horror film that really exaggerates and delves into how hard it is to be a ballerina and how much you have to give up to your craft. And there's the scene where she's really bending her toes to fit into the ballet shoes, and and then Suspiria really blows that way out of proportion, how they contort their bodies in a ballet setting. And then this film, I think it does have that element to it where you can kind of feel her pain in the ballet school and what she's doing to her body. I think because obviously those films are full-on horror films, I'd say Girl is less sensationalist in how it shows the pain of ballet. Even though it shows her bleeding toes, it I think it quickly goes away from that back to Lara's face, because it wants to stay with her. It's her experience. It's not like you're looking at her. It wants you to be with her. And even in the ballet scenes, there are very few wide shots. It feels like often it just stays on Lara, and the camera moves with her around the room rather than the whole setting.
Mm. Yeah, it's worth pointing out that there are a number of areas that have been challenged by the trans community in the film. The writer-director of the film and the film star identify as cis male, and perhaps this is not a story to be told by cisgender filmmakers.
Yeah, I think there are some interesting debates we had around that. Again, we're not here to speak as members of the trans community, but you know, hoping to approach this from a position of sort of allyship, I do struggle with this sort of cisgender casting and directing, because I think there are just too many opportunities for unhelpful narratives to be foregrounded and sort of misinformation to be put forward here that serves little purpose other than really to sort of play into, you know, a lot of common transphobic misconceptions and abuse, really. There are issues there around what kinds of information can be put forward by people who have not lived that experience.
Yeah, certainly. So I think it's definitely one, because there is such a wide variety of opinion on there to check out for yourselves. You can do so in cinemas and on demand. That's Girl, which is out this week. And now we're moving from Belgium to Holland, as it's time for some Amstel.
Okay, listen.
Oh, no. What? Oh, you don't have to eat the porridge. Let me pressure you into porridge.
No. Is it weird if we carry on hanging out? If you have stuff to do?
No, I've got nothing. Yeah, go on. What should we do with our lives?
We could get some mushrooms.
Magic mushrooms? Or just mushrooms?
Magic mushrooms.
That sounds fun. Let's get some of those mushrooms.
Yeah?
Hmm?
Cool. So, with the porridge?
Oh, fuck the porridge. No, we'll eat the porridge.
Okay.
Ella, could you tell us a little bit about the film from the former host of Pop World and Nevermind the Buzzcocks?
I can indeed. So this is the film directed by Simon Anstall. This is called Benjamin, and it's a story of a filmmaker who's on the brink of releasing the tough second feature film, who is searching for critical and emotional validation. But when he's introduced to French musician Noah, maybe he hopes that he can break these cycles of distraction and anxiety and be content, not just with Noah, but also with himself.
Yes, and here is what happened when I sat down with Simon himself.
Simon Amstel, thanks so much for coming on the Curzon podcast.
That's all right, Jake. I'm thrilled.
Yes. So we're actually sat in Curzon Soho, which is where you shot a few scenes for your new film, Benjamin. It's also where the main character, a filmmaker, has quite a tough time introducing his new film. And we're doing this interview just after you've introduced your film. So is this place becoming some kind of weird filmmaking purgatory for you?
I guess it would be if I wasn't having such a lovely time. But it's great. It's exciting to be here again. I think the last time I was here was when we were shooting. I was feeling a bit stressful coming through the corridor to get to this room, where we shot a corridor scene with a tracking shot, and it took a long time to get right. And then we locked somebody in an office. This isn't very interesting. But anyway, it was
thrilling.
The corridor was a bit stressful for me. You can cut that out if that isn't interesting enough.
I'm sure we've got a lot of fans familiar with the geography of Curzon Soho. They're wondering which closet it must have been.
Yeah.
There are so many iconic ones in this building. All right, so the name of the film is Benjamin. And that is who is the main character in the film, which is unusual for a romance, I felt. But where often maybe the partner of the film might get the title. But to me, I read this film as much as it's a romance, it's a film about kind of self-love as well. And that's why the name of the film is Benjamin.
That's true. Yeah, you're right. It's really a coming-of-age story. It's really about Benjamin learning to love and be loved. He starts the film completely defended. All he wants is the love of an audience, because he's terrified of intimacy. And slowly, over the course of the film, Noah, this very beautiful French musician, breaks down his defences and teaches him to love himself and others. Yes. Well spotted.
Oh, well, thank you. I realise you passed me my notebook today, and just a moment ago, you may have seen what was tucked underneath it as well.
I didn't. What was tucked underneath it?
It was actually your book.
That's my book. Oh, that's good.
And so it was after I watched the film last week, and then so picked this up, delve into it. And I think that was where I got kind of more explored the idea of this being a journey into the self as much as it is into a relationship. And the opening of the film is revealed to be a film within a film, a film that Benjamin has made called No Self. And that was the name of your 2007 tour, as well as being a kind of a Buddhist principle.
Yes.
And do you see the era of that Benjamin is in as similar to you in that time, or is it more of an amalgamation of your experiences over the last decade, 15 years or so?
I keep saying in interviews that I wrote it as a way of trying to figure out what was wrong with me in my 20s. What I realized with that title, which was originally a stand-up show, was how pretentious I was. And so when I came to write this Benjamin character, who is pretentious because he's desperate for validation and he's just trying anything that will make people think he's cool, he'd be so thrilled to be at the Curzon. So he calls his film No Self, and he has a monk in it, and it's just full of Buddhist philosophy that doesn't really make any sense. And yeah, I can't remember how I started this sentence, but I can't remember what did I say? What was the beginning of the sentence?
Oh, something profound. You sounded like a Buddhist monk. I think you should put that into a film.
Yeah. You'll edit some of this, right?
Definitely.
Okay, good.
And so that film within a film, No Self, I'm curious how, when you started making Benjamin, how do you think about what the film looks like, and how do you think about what the film within the film looks like?
It was good having this film within the film because we got to do all the worst things that you can do, I think, as a director, which is try too hard, throw in shots that aren't serving the story but are just a bit flashy. So he throws in every odd camera angle. The grade is really try hard. The acting is slightly wonky as well somehow.
There was a particular pet peeve of mine.
Go on.
Well, actually, maybe in your next film you desperately want to shoot something in 4:3.
Oh yeah, and it's 4:3. Yeah, that's the other thing. But he's seen Andrea Arnold and he's seen Xavier Dolan and he's gone, I need to be more like those guys. Yeah. I need to be really cool. And he's kind of forgotten that he's funny. His first film, which was called Happy, was a funny film and kind of effortless. And so the way we shot Benjamin was in this more effortless, or at least seemingly effortless way. And it's a film about intimacy. It's a film about a character a character who is eventually convinced by this other character, Noah, to just be a bit more easy and just be in a moment with another human being without having to feel like he has to be someone better. So we wanted the cinematography to not get in the way of the story, to feel like just appropriate to what was going on in the moment. We want to have, you know, we want to be quite creative at the same time. And I think it looks quite beautiful, but not in a way that's trying to be beautiful, just appropriately beautiful.
Yeah, well, it's, to me, great cinematography, great editing doesn't tell you it's there.
Yes, that's it. That's it.
And you mentioned this is a film about intimacy, and something that I really loved about it that I don't see enough in a lot of films is how you can show character, and in this case, tenderness, through food. And I actually found the porridge in this scene.
I was like, what are you talking about? Yeah. The porridge, yeah.
And that's actually a really sweet
moment.
Because
he cooks it for him.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
And I didn't know, excuse the pun, whether that was a baked-in idea that you could you could find a moment through food. Because I think food is a really personal thing. And particularly porridge, where people do cook it in their own way.
That's true, yes. There was a lot of talk about how the porridge should be made that day. And Colin Morgan, who plays Benjamin, was talking a lot about how he puts almond butter in his porridge, but that doesn't seem like the right thing to do.
How'd you make your porridge?
God, so complicated. My porridge is just like full of seeds and protein powders. I mean, nobody apart from me would want to eat my porridge, so it doesn't look, you know, that's not my porridge in that film.
No.
Because it wouldn't have been such a joyful scene. It would have just been like confusing.
Well, I still think it's a great way of building up a person, like what food they eat, what books they read. There are these bookshelves that it's not like you linger on particular things to let us know, oh, he's read in Inherent Vice or something. But I wonder, did you think about what might be on the shelf of Benjamin?
Every book on his shelf is handpicked. There's a lot about directing. There are a lot of self-help books. There are a lot of books on Buddhism. I'm trying to think. Like it was a lot of the books on his shelf are the books that I read in preparation for directing the film. I can't remember what they're called, but I think he's also got Story by Robert McKee, the big screenplay book. And I think there's a book on his shelf that's just called Directing Actors that I read at some point. And Truth by Susan Batson, all these kind of books. Yeah.
And what kind of films do you think Benji?
No, call him Benji. I mean, you enjoyed his porridge.
it looked pretty good. What kind of films would Benjamin be watching?
Well, I think if you asked him in an interview situation like this, he would tell you that he'd been watching a lot of Truffaut and I don't know. He'd try and sound very impressive. He'd probably go to the Curzon bathroom, write down some of the posters that he sees in that bathroom, and then come back and tell you the films that he's really loved. But if he was being honest, I think he would tell you that he fell in love with film after watching Back to the Future, and loves, I don't know, comedies that aren't necessarily particularly cool. He might, you know, he might say that he really liked and was affected by Notting Hill. But he wouldn't say that. He'd, he'd keep that inside.
Yeah.
Because he was terrified of not being cool enough and not being validated by cool people.
But you don't need that anymore.
I don't need that, of course, because I'm you know, I'm very well. And yes. I've had a lot of therapy and, you know, whatever Noah teaches him in the film, I've been taught.
And you're happy to say now that Notting Hill is your favourite film.
Notting Hill's my favourite film. I'm doing that Mark Kermode thing at the BFI next week. And, you know, he does a thing called Guilty Pleasures. Mm. And I don't really subscribe to the idea of any pleasure being, guilty. I think if it's pleasurable.
It's guilt-free.
And legal. And everyone consents. It's why I feel guilty about it. And he asked me which film I wanted to talk about, and I'm going to talk about Titanic, I think, because it really affected me as a child. I know it's like an enormous, you know, huge blockbuster of a film, but it made me cry a lot when I was 15. And my mum had just got remarried to this stepfather character. I didn't really like him very much, and I thought she'd married him just because he had a house. So I took my mum and my grandma to see Titanic, and this isn't really what you asked, but I took them to see Titanic to teach them that true love is more important than financial security. It was a big moment in my life. And as the credits rolled, I turned to my grandma to say, you know, see? And my grandma said, how could she leave such a rich man? So I love Titanic.
Yeah. I understand it's important as well for you for the way that Leonardo DiCaprio's hair falls over his eyes.
Oh, my God. Well, yeah, and also in Romeo and Juliet. I mean, that was a very confusing time for me. Yes.
All right. Whilst none of these events, as we established, happened to you, the feelings, they did happen, the feelings of Benjamin. Is there a catharsis in putting him on screen? Do you feel like there is you're letting go of this era?
A little bit, in the changes in me are much clearer, having fictionalized certain aspects of myself. One example is attending the premiere at the London Film Festival last year. I was feeling quite nervous. I had to do a speech at the beginning, and I thought, oh, Benjamin felt really nervous on this night for him in the film, and he was a mess and had a major crisis and breakdown afterwards. Do I really want that to be my life now? I feel like there's no point in fictionalizing parts of yourself unless you're going to get better. So I thought, let's let him go. Let that character go. He doesn't have to exist within you anymore. You understand him. You wrote this in order to figure out what was wrong with you. And I had a lovely time. I sat there in the audience. People were laughing. I thought, oh, this is great. This is great news. I'm not insane for thinking that this was a good idea to make this film. It's being received very well. People are not just making laughing noises, but noises that make me feel like they care for the character and want him to do well. And then afterwards, the Q&A went very well. And it was just the most amazing night. And I suppose it helped that I'd made a better film than Benjamin had made. I hadn't ruined my life by making a terrible, pretentious film.
Mm. And Benjamin tries to solve that by throwing himself immediately into the next project as well.
Yes.
But as people are enjoying this film, you can relish into it.
Yeah, I can relish for maybe a week. Yes. I can do a week of relishing, and then I might have to figure out what I'm doing with my life.
Yeah. Well, I think that's something that I really empathize with in his character, is that it is this creation that he is compelled to do, to make things, but it's also that gives him his stress and his anxieties, but he can't escape from it, even though he is the creator of it.
Yeah. It's a nightmare.
Yeah.
It's a nightmare. And
and you're just going to go and do that again, aren't you?
I guess so. But I think the difference is that he is obsessed with the results of what he does. And I've come to the conclusion that it's all about the joy of doing the thing rather than any acclaim that you get afterwards. Because even if you get all the acclaim that you think you need, it only lasts a minute, and then you have to go and do another thing for more acclaim. So if you're in, if you're, you know, if you're that, yeah, what was I going to say? Anyway, let's end that there. Whatever I said, what was the last thing I said? It only lasts for a minute, and then you have to go and get more acclaim.
Yeah.
So that's not a good cycle to be on. In or on?
In. I think you're in a cycle.
That's not a good cycle to be in. Better to just enjoy what you're doing, right?
Definitely.
Yeah. I'm a bit high because I've done 18 interviews today.
Yeah.
So I don't even know what human beings sound like anymore. All I've heard is my own voice saying similar things over and over again. And I keep repeating the same thing in interviews. That seems to be happening as well, because I'm not sure if I've said them or not.
Well, I mean, they're all new to me.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. Okay, cool.
Great. Simon, thanks so much
for
joining us.
Is that all right?
That's great.
Is
yeah,
it
you
the
don't...
best Curzon podcast you've ever been involved in?
Absolutely, yes.
Better than Isabel Huppert?
Yeah, I mean, who cares about Isabel Huppert when you've got Simon Amstel, you know? I mean, you would do a fantastic job in The Piano Teacher, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, thanks. Yeah, that was horrible when she put glass in the bag, didn't she?
Then stabbed herself.
And then stabbed herself.
Yeah.
He never leaves you with a happy ending, does he, that guy?
What, Michael Haneke?
Michael Haneke. That, what was the one with they died in the apartment?
Amour.
Amour. And then the credits roll. He doesn't even give you a song on the credits. No. Just nothing.
What would you have ended Amour with? Wonderwall?
Maybe, Wonderwall. No, I don't know. Maybe something like Forget Your Troubles, Come On, Get Happy?
Forget your troubles, come on, get happy.
Yep.
What about that?
Yeah, I think that's a good choice. I feel like you could suggest it to him. Next time Haneke asks you for notes.
Yeah. If I met him, I think I'd end up saying, what do you want from us? What you... You know, we're all living very difficult lives. This is not helping.
Mm.
But he obviously is a great artist.
Yeah, but, you know, cheer up.
Yeah, okay, there you go.
All right, cheers, Simon. Thanks.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Thank you.
So I know there's a few fans here that would have been watching Pop World and Buzzcocks back in the day. Would either of you imagine that this is what Simon Amstel would have been doing now?
Nope.
Probably not. Not
really. Considering before Pop World, he was like a presenter on a children's show, and he was removed from that children's show because he was too sarcastic to the kids. And so that he's made something, as you say, so like sincere is very surprising.
I think Simon Amstel is hilarious, but yeah, it's always been interesting to see what he's going to do next. And this is definitely a romantic film. It's very sweet. It's very kind of clear that he's worked through a lot of his own personal traumas and issues to sort of create this really, you know, beautiful. I think it's a really beautiful film. And yeah, maybe some people would think, is this going to be totally insufferable? It's a film about filmmakers in East London and, you know, these sort of tortured male artists. But I honestly think it's wonderful. I think Colin Morgan, he plays Benjamin, the lead character, is great. He's so charming. I don't know if it's because he's Northern Irish, but he's just wonderful in the role and really kind of carries this film with a sensitivity, great humour. He has great comic timing, really funny. And it's clear that he's not trying to be Simon Amstel. You know, there's a lot of similarities between Amstel's life and the film that he's making. But I think Colin Morgan really carries, you know, holds his own here and is not trying to sort of mimic or do an impression of Simon Amstel, which is really important.
Yeah, it's quite a slight film. I don't think it's good. People aren't going to be bashing down the doors of cinemas to check it out.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's the kind of film that people are going to find. and just kind of stumble on and get comfort from that. It kind of feels like this London version of so many Sundance films that we see turn out kind of a bit sun-dappled, romantic and easygoing.
Yeah, but I think having that London edge, if I may, like makes it seem like the kind of film that I would urge people to seek it out, because I think it seems slight, but if slight was a positive adjective, it would have every defining, like Benjamin would be everything positive about the word slight, because it has, as I say, Caitlin, that really sharp humour, and it's just so tight throughout. And I think the difference with a lot of the reason that people would dub Sundance films as kind of a negative thing is that they can kind of seem forgettable and all of these characters just kind of blend into each other and, you know, you forget who they really are. But Colin Morgan just brings Benjamin to life in a way that you think this is definitely Simon Amstel with his comedy who's written it. But he's just this, like, he's a character that you remember and that you care for, and throughout you know, I found myself after the film finished thinking, I wonder what Benjamin's doing. Yeah.
Well, comparing to those kind of films, I think what makes this one stand out and why it doesn't just fall into the pantheon of kind of charming romance films that we kind of forget about is that it's able to cut through the treacle and it's able to have a bit of self-awareness. And I think that comes from Amstel's script. I think if this were a pretty straight and narrow film about filmmakers struggling with their anxieties and their romance, it could be tough to get through, but there is just the right amount of self-awareness. I mean, he's not Deadpool, but
but who is?
But I think there's just enough through it, and that he is taking the mick out of himself just the right amount to be able to get through it and make it enjoyable. I mean, I particularly like the way that he constructs, as we talk about in the interview, the kind of pretentious filmmaking that a filmmaker like him would make. And that's kind of Amstel acknowledging that, yeah, I am that guy a bit, actually. And if I did have my way, I may end up making quite a terrible art house film influenced by Buddhist philosophy, shot on film and projected in 4:3. He's capable of that, but he was able to reel it in. And it certainly made me forget about the Simon Amstel character that we saw for 15 years, and suddenly he feels like a real person. And part of that authenticity, I think, comes from the dialogue in the film, and that we're not just seeing anxiety or depression through stilted silences and frustrations like that. We're over-expressing to make up for the fact we're under-expressing.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's clear that Amstel's kind of using this creative process as a kind of catharsis. There's a therapy involved for him, but yeah, part of it is about keeping it funny and keeping it relatable in this kind of, you know, word vomit kind of way, where actually these characters really say so much but say very little. You know, they're sort of babbling, and Benjamin is over talking, and with Noah especially, and his love interest in some of those sort of romantic scenes, the things he says is, you know, you want to cringe and you just want to sort of hug him and tell him to be quiet, because he's you know, revealing far too much, you'd think, but that's just how he needs to get all this out of him, and he has no real filter on his brain, I guess, for now. And it's really interesting that this is something that I think we've seen crop up in quite a few films recently, this overexpression and excessive dialogue and characters who want to get their feelings out but really struggle to say it succinctly and clearly to the people around them.
Yeah, and anyone who's recently watched the new episodes of Fleabag, I think Fleabag's dad is a great one for just constantly talking without actually saying anything. He has a great speech at a dinner table in episode one of the new one, which I would urge people to check out. Let's step away from Amstel and Noah and Benjamin for a bit and get a bit more technical and look at the score and the cinematography of this film, because they're certainly worth highlighting. The score is by James Wrighton, member of Klaxons. Yep. So with all this Pop World Buzzcocks chat, it's very much a 2007 type feel.
Yeah, it was James Wrighton and Simon Amstel actually wrote together the lyrics and the music for some of the songs that Noah performs. He's a musician, and that's sort of how Benjamin sort of comes to fall in love with him, I suppose. But yeah, they worked together on the music, and I imagine that must have been a real kind of soothing process as well. You know, there's writing a script and getting your emotions out that way, but there's something obviously so much more kind of intensely personal, I suppose, about writing song lyrics and having them be performed, you know, by one of your characters. But yeah, I think the score is really beautiful.
And there's the thing that I love so much about the music in this film is that I really think that it just emphasises and anchors the way that Benjamin is feeling so much, because as opposed to just sitting under everything he's saying to make it sound like more romantic or Hollywood or whatever, it fills a lot of the silences. So often it comes in like the second after Benjamin has finished saying whatever thing he's panicking about, and often it's as soon as he's finished talking to Noah or Noah's just walked away, then you have this lovely, just warm, mellow, tinkly piano coming in, and it just makes me think of like the second that someone leaves, when you start like replaying the conversation in your head, yeah, and like what you think of that person and how it all ended up, and you've got here that score that actually like helps that, and just I feel like it really initiates that immediate nostalgia that you'd have like as a viewer.
Shout out to David Pym as well, the cinematographer on this. You've got these manages to build a real sense of location and space about London, but also those moments of intimacy, like little moments of cooking or in a bath. And again, it's not that, I don't know quite how to describe it, Vimeo DSLR shaky lens flare look. It feels like composed, mm-hmm, but without being constructed, I suppose. And this is very much a London film. We did a call out on Twitter to get any low-key London locations from our followers there to complement the Curzon Soho bathrooms that feature in the film. So as a nod to our recording space, which is Soho Radio on Great Wilmill Street, I would like to highlight the phone boxes on this very street featured in Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. At tweets by Joff says the Newman Passage in Disobedience. I mean, credits to the guy who can pull out like an alley. I know those bricks. Yes. And Papaya Films must have been lucky enough to see In Fabric already, as they've pointed out that there is an appearance of the shop Jackson's of Reading in Croydon, which makes up the department store in that film. You didn't tell me, guys, that it was Jackson's of Reading. Now I'm really excited about In Fabric. Gosh. Right, was there any other low-key London locations?
Well, if you watch Thor The Dark World, you'll see that the ending is set in Greenwich, Jake.
Yeah.
You said low-key, right? Low-key's in that film.
Ella, any for yourself?
Just two small mentions. You know, I'm a big fan of train stations. I commute a lot. So we've got Paddington Station in Paddington, and then we have About Time. Now I didn't know which tube station this was, so I'm gonna go with the result that I found during my research, which is The Tube.
I think it might be Maid of Vale.
Thank you, Jake.
That's only because I recently rewatched it and had to pause it because I had to learn what it was.
Oh, you had to? Yeah. Yes.
All right. So that's Benjamin and Girl, which are out in cinemas and on home cinema this week. And we've got a new addition to the home cinema service. That is Wildlife. We delved into this one quite a few months ago now. So go back and listen to that episode if you want to, but it's certainly a recommendation.
Absolutely, yes. I love Wildlife. I still do. I wrote about it way back when as well. There is an article on the Curzon blog where I talk about Jeanette Brinson, who is Carey Mulligan's character in Wildlife, alongside Veronica Rawlings, who is in Widows.
Yes, it's a great piece. Do go and check that one out if you can. But that's really about it. If you've got any thoughts on Girl or Benjamin or any more of those low-key London locations, do let us
there
know.
There might be some in Avengers, I don't know, or Thor 1 or for Ragnarok. Or Infinity War.
There's Edinburgh, isn't there?
There is Edinburgh. Yeah,
We will deep fry your kebab. if you've got any of those, do let us know by emailing podcast@curzon.com for next week's show, or you can tweet us, as the others have done, at Curzon Cinemas. If it's your first time listening, please subscribe. You can do that on iTunes, Spotify, Acast, wherever you get your podcasts. And when you're there, do leave us a review or a comment. It would be wonderful. Next week, we'll be talking about Jordan Peele's Us, and we'll also be talking to the legendary Rafe Fiennes about his directorial effort, The White Crow. Until next time, though, if you want to keep up with us, you can follow Ella on Twitter at
EFE Kemp.
And Caitlin, it's your first time on the show. Follow you on Twitter at
CSA Quinlan.
Yeah, and they can find some writing from you as well.
They can indeed. Yep. I've got some stuff coming up for Sight and Sound, Little White Lies, my usual spot. Have a read.
And Sam, if people really hate themselves and want to follow you,
if people have nothing better to do to find it, yeah, if you want any more Loki locations, you can follow me at samhowlett_1.
Brilliant. And if you want to keep up with me, I'm at Jake H. Cunningham. Thank you so much for listening. Farewell.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.